when people praise me for the things I have done. Because in truth, I haven't done anything. I think actually that's a worthwhile thing for everybody to keep in mind. Because as Yogananda said in Autobiography of a Yogi, thoughts are universally, not individually rooted. And we don't create our thoughts, we merely transmit them. We're transmitting stations. This is a scientific fact. And if you turn your mind upward to God, He does things through you. And there's no limit to how much He can do. There's no such thing as a miracle in the world. There's only the use of the functioning of things that are beyond what we know of spiritual law. But the truth is that everything is a miracle. And everything is really done by God. And the more we let Him do it through us, the more we can accomplish. We don't do anything. And so it's not humility on my part that says, I don't do anything. It's simple common sense, simple facing the facts. I don't do anything. But then none of us does anything. He does everything. He is dreaming this whole show. And the more we recognize and let Him do it through us, the more we can accomplish, or rather I should say, the more He can accomplish through us. I was in the hospital with double pneumonia several years ago in the Privat hospital here in Gurgaon, not very far away from here. And I was hardly conscious. I think I nearly died in that time. And a doctor came into my room. And you know, doctors come in to help you, right? Well, the doctor said to me, "Sir, can you help me?" I was a little surprised, and I said, "Well, I'll try." He said, "I have a son in college in Canada. I have many expenses." He asked me, "How can I meet all my expenses and be truth to Dharma?" He said, "I believe in yogic principles. I believe in high principles, but it's so difficult for me to make ends meet and be completely honest." I answered him to his surprise. I said that I have done many things in my life by adhering very strictly to Dharma. I believe in this principle of Dharma in every way imaginable. There is no moment in life where it is all right to cut corners. I have been willing to take great chances in the name of this belief. Some years ago, I was sued by a group of people who hired the third largest legal firm in the world. I didn't have that kind of money. I had almost no money. I hired, however, not because of the money aspect, but because he was a dharmic man. I hired a lawyer who didn't even have a secretary. But I hired him because he was dharmic. The other side told lie after lie. I refused to tell any lies. I said, if God wants me to fail in everything I do, that's His business. I'm not going to interfere. He brought me out triumphant from the whole thing. We won everything. And they lost everything. Well, that's an example of what I mean. When you are dharmic, yata dharma, tata jaya. Where there is dharma, there is victory. And with victory, there is satisfaction, there is comfort, there is happiness. So dharma is the essence of spiritual teaching, the essence of the teachings of India. And it pains me. Mr. Kartikeyan took me to meet Abdul Kalam a few years ago, and he was the president. And Abdul Kalam said, "What changes have you seen in India since you first came here in 1958? That's before a few of you were born. And I said, "Well, I know that India has become more materialistic. I don't meet this number of saints that I used to meet. I used to spend a lot of time with Anandamayi Ma and other great saints. But on the other hand, India has to claim its place as one of the leaders of leading countries of the world. That is its rightful place, and it must be materialistic for a while, but it will not lose its spirituality. However, there is one aspect of the change that I have been observing in India. There's a little diminution of the grasp of Dharma. Politicians willing to get into power by unscrupulous means, businessmen willing to make success of their lives by unscrupulous means. I don't think that should be. I remember when I built Ananda, I had to do all the work myself. I didn't have wealthy donors. I had to give classes. I had to give classes. I gave them for a very small fee because I wanted everyone to benefit from them. But there was one time when I was making all this money, working so hard, somebody came to me and he said, "I've just inherited some money and I would like to ask your advice. Shall I join Ananda or shall I use this money to go to India?" I asked him how much money it was. He said, $200,000. The money in that time would be about $1 million today. I said, I wasn't even tempted. I had only asked him how much he was getting to make sure that he had enough money to go to India. I said, "I advise you to go to India." I never saw him again. I never heard from him again. I didn't regret it for a moment. I only wanted to do what was right. He had asked me for what I thought was best for him. That's what I thought was best for him at that time. I have never cut corners, and I have found that somehow everything has always come to me, and in amazing ways. Sometimes, one time in California, I felt after 10 years away from India, that Divine Mother, I always think of God as my Divine Mother. I said, "Divine Mother," I felt that she wanted me to go back to India. And I had a little money from classes, and people had given me some money, enough to come to India and spend maybe 2 months and then go back. I was driving my car into San Francisco and the rod blew. Whatever rods do, I don't know about cars. But anyway, I needed a new car. And I thought, well, Divine Mother, if I have to have a car when I live, because I live in the mountains, I can't get along without one. But if I buy a car, how will I go to India? I said, "Divine Mother, it's your problem." So I said, my common sense tells me I need to get a car. So I'll put down some of this money. And I put down $1,100, and then I got $700 for the old clunker. And with that, I was able to get a decent used car. That was Friday night. Monday morning in the mail, I received a letter with a check made out to me personally. And the letter said, it was for $1,000. The letter said, "Use this as Divine Mother wants you to." Now, how he even knew that I think of God as my Divine Mother. Nobody in America does. I do. But that letter said that. I have seen again and again that when I live for Divine Mother, she takes care of me in the littlest ways even. And in the biggest ways. I know my parents were stationed in France, and I kept thinking of, because I had gone to school in Switzerland, I kept thinking it would be nice if they, Switzerland's very near France, if they could send me some Swiss chocolate. And I didn't have, it was such a minor desire, I kept forgetting to write about it when I wrote to them. And just one day before my birthday, I was thinking a week before my birthday, "Oh, Divine Mother, I didn't remember to ask them, and now it's my birthday, and it's too bad. It would have been nice." A perfectly unnecessary desire. There was no life being saved, nothing at principle, just a desire. The day before my birthday, I got a letter from somebody in a box of Swiss chocolates, She said I was passing this shop, and she didn't know it was my birthday. She just thought I felt like sending these to you. So I got a box of Swiss chocolates for my birthday from somebody who didn't know that it was even my birthday. I have seen, you know, when Divine Mother takes care of you in unnecessary ways, that's in a way even more touching. I remember I was in, whenever I do something special for Divine Mother, I like to celebrate with her. And I went to Carmel by the Sea, which is very near to, it's a beautiful place in California where people go on vacation. And I thought, all right, I've written this thing for Divine Mother, now I want to go and celebrate with her. And I got to Carmel, I forgot that it was August. All the hotel rooms were taken. You have to reserve long in advance. And I didn't know what to do. I thought, well, Divine Mother, you've got to help me out here. So I went to my favorite hotel there, and they said, well, they had one room, but it was much more than I could afford. I said, Divine Mother, I've come here to celebrate with you. I must go through with this. So I started to take out the money to pay for my room. He said, no, don't pay me. I said, well, I'd rather pay you now than later. I just was afraid I wouldn't have it by the time I left. And he said, no, don't pay me at all. I said, why not? He said, I'll just write you down as a travel agent. Why? I don't know. I just like you. And later that day, I went to lunch, and the owner of the restaurant, who didn't know me from anybody, he wouldn't let me pay for my food. I said, Divine Mother, you know how to take care of me in even little ways. You will see this in your life. If you give your life to God and believe strongly in Dharma, you will find the truth. Yata Dharma Stata Jaya. Don't tell lies. Don't try to bend the rules yourself. You don't have to do it. If you live according to Dharma and not adharma, then Dharma itself will take care of you. What is Dharma? Basically, the literal meaning of Dharma is that which ties together, which binds together. What you have to understand from that very difficult to understand statement is that it means that which helps you to see the oneness of everything. This whole universe is just one truth. You know, we can tell truths now that we couldn't tell even 100, 200 years ago. Now we have discovered, this is my Param Guru, Swami Sri Yukteswar, explained that this is no longer Kali Yuga. He said that in Kali Yuga, people made the mistake and made them erred in their computation. We are now in Dwapara. Dwapara Yuga began in 1900. And Dwapara Yuga is an age of energy. Here nowadays you hear people using the word energy all the time. In this age of energy, we have come already to understand many things. It will demolish the delusion of space, and people will go to distant planets. Already we've sent missions to the moon, to Mars. It will be a normal way to live. UFOs are just the beginning of the story. We will be sending missions to other planets. But in this Dwapara Yuga, we understand now that this matter is not solid. It's really only made of energy. Matter is a vibration of energy. Energy is a vibration of thoughts. Thoughts are a vibration of consciousness, and consciousness is God. I remember I didn't know anything about the Indian teachings. I was looking for God. I didn't know what God was. I had rejected the thought of God because I felt that in my church they made God so boring. I thought, who wants that kind of God? And so I tried to find truth through science, through politics, through literature, through music, through any way that I could find. And I found that without God, nothing can be found. Nothing can be found. I was interested in truth, and no truth could exist without God. And I finally reached the point of realizing there has to be a God. And I was studying playwriting in Charleston, South Carolina, and I went out into the night and I said to myself, if there's a God, what must he be? He can't be a policeman up there or a judge. What is it making me ask this question? The fact that I'm conscious. And if I'm conscious and can consciously ask this question, then he must be consciousness. And I must be a manifestation of that consciousness. And then the goal of life must be simply this, to unite my consciousness, to attune my consciousness with his, in order to become more conscious. And I realized then that the goal of life has to be to seek God. I had not read the lives of saints. I had certainly not read Vedanta philosophy, which I discovered in that one night. And I thought, am I going crazy? And I remember going upstate New York and trying to get away from this fear of madness that I was falling into. I'd never read that anybody had ever sought God before, let alone found him. It seemed like a crazy concept. And I tried to think maybe I need to live among simple villagers. I found the villagers more stupid than the cities. I found that I would look at the beautiful dewdrop on a leaf, and I would think, yes, that's beautiful, but I couldn't feel it. There was a block between me and that beauty. It was as if I were a motor beating on only one cylinder. Do motors beat on cylinders? I don't know. Anyway, working on one cylinder. And I decided then I must seek God. And I came upon, I know my parents, if my parents had been in America at that time, in where I was, it would have been very difficult to leave. It was completely sudden. But God arranged it that my father was sent to Egypt to explore for oil there. The very day that I put my mother on the ship, this again was an indication of God's help. The day I put my mother on the ship, I walked uptown New York and discovered Autobiography of a Yogi in a bookstore there. And I read that book, and in just a few days, he said he was a vegetarian. I said, all right, I'm a vegetarian. He said, I'm a monk. All right, I'll be a monk. And as soon as I finished that book, I took the next bus across the country, as Mr. Kartikayan was saying, and I came to Yogananda, and I asked that if I could be his disciple. And I've been that ever since. I'm now in the 64th year of my discipleship. God takes care of you if you ask him to. If he doesn't come into your life, it's because you don't invite him. Why should he intrude? He's very humble himself. He doesn't want to force himself on you. But honestly, if you give your life to him, if you will say that everything that I own is yours, even my thoughts are yours, if you will live in that dharma, you will discover that he will take care of you. He will take care of you in the smallest little thing. I have found that every need I have ever had has been given to me. I've never had to worry about it. I could go on and on and on with stories to prove this point. But I would like to say that in this age where people are experimenting, they believe in science, why not do this experiment? Give God a chance in your life. Say, God, I will try to do my best to live for you. You please do what you want with me. And I've never known it to fail. There was one time, I know there was a story in Ireland of a priest who came to a farmer. He said, what a beautiful house God has given you. What a beautiful family God has given you. What a beautiful farm God has given you. The farmer said, well, Father, you may be right, but you should have seen this land when God had it all to himself.
We have to do something ourselves. You can't just sit back and expect him to do it. But when you do it with him, hand in hand, then you'll discover that everything works right. I remember there was a devotee of my guru's. He was from Calcutta. And he, my guru said to him one day, "Why are you always so light and joking all the time, keeping people's minds restless?" And he said, Devi Mukherjee, his name was. He said, "Devi, I want to change, but Master, I want to change, but how can I do it without your blessings?" Master said, "My blessings are there. God's blessings are there. It's your blessings that are lacking. We've got to do it, be in the act. We've got to do something ourselves. Don't sit back passively waiting for God to do that." This is a sad fact of Indian history. When the Muslims came, they converted by fire and sword. When the English came, they converted by sneers. Sneers were much harder to take. Indians began to become a little passive. India didn't used to be. You know, when Marco Polo lived, he was in the 13th and 14th centuries. He came through China on his way back to Venice. And he said that the richest country in the world is India. The next century, England came. England became a very wealthy country. India became poor. One suspects a cause-effect relationship. India will again become rich. But I urge you to do it dharmically. Don't think of cutting corners. God will take care of you if you take care of yourself in his name. So the more that you live for him, the more you will see. There was I know there were a couple of ladies in America who never locked their car. Yogananda said, "Well, you should lock your car. Don't tempt faith." They said, "What is your faith in God?" He said, "Well, I have faith in God, but I think God expects me to do my share too." And so one day, they'd bought some very valuable paintings and put them in the car and left the car without locking it. And somebody came in and took them all away, and they were very unhappy. Master said, "You see, you have to do your part. Just lock the car. Do your little duty, and then he will do the rest. But if you say, 'All right, God, you do it,' he won't. He doesn't do it. He doesn't work that way. When you act correctly, he will act with you." So dharma is an absolute necessity. There is one dharma in the entire universe. It is Sanatan Dharma, the eternal religion. Religion also means dharma. Religare in Latin, to bind. And this religion has to be the same religion in the most distant galaxy of this universe. Because it means that everything came from God, everything must go back to God. Your goal is to go back to God. Your goal is to realize that you are God. Or to put it more accurately, God is you. A saint is not somebody who's different from anybody else. He's a sinner too. But a saint, as my guru said, is a sinner who never gave up. So never give up. Never say, "Oh, I'm a sinner, main papi hoon." Don't talk like that. Say, "I'm a child of God," no matter how many mistakes you make. He can always, if you keep trying. I remember when I was 21 years old, I used to smoke. And then because of this long process that I went through, I reached the point of realizing I needed to to know God. And I thought of becoming a hermit. And I thought, well, who ever heard of a hermit who smokes? And so I thought, well, I've got to give up smoking. Mark Twain said that smoking is the easiest habit in the world to give up. I've done it 1,000 times. Well, that's how it was with me. I gave it up in the morning. At lunch with my coffee, I would like to have a cigarette and I'd go back to it. But each time, and this is a very important principle to remember, each time I never said, "I have failed." I always said, I have not yet succeeded. So each time I failed, it became an affirmation of success. After 1 year, I know I was rooming with four other men, and I told this roommate of mine, I've given up smoking. He said, oh, I've heard that one before. I said, no, I haven't given up. I had a half-empty packet of cigarettes. I gave them out to my friends. I never took another. I wasn't even tempted. But it took that year of saying I haven't yet succeeded to breach the point where I had affirmed enough and really believed that I did give it up. So whatever your weaknesses, whatever your faults, never say, this is who I am. A saint is a sinner. Remember this. A saint is a sinner who never gave up. If you don't give up, you will become a saint. There's nothing between you and Babaji and Krishna and Jesus Christ and the great masters of all the ages except the simple thought that you're not. You can change that thought. You can become a saint. If you love God, the spiritual path looks very difficult. It is difficult because we make it difficult. I remember my guru was asked once, sir, I don't think I have very good karma. He answered, remember this, it takes very, very, very good karma even to want to know God. People reach the human level of evolution, and there's so many mistakes they can make. If this girl doesn't do it, that girl may, or the other girl may. If this man isn't satisfactory, maybe he or maybe you, and so on. If this palace doesn't work, maybe I can build another one. And desires are endless. But when you have reached the point of just meditating a little bit, when you follow the path of Dharma, when you do what is right, you begin to feel finally such a satisfaction in your heart. You don't want anything. It doesn't take a great effort to give it up if you don't want it, and you reach the point of not wanting it. I remember I was in Florence some 5 years ago, Florence, Italy, and had a dream there. And in this dream I saw thousands of people. And some of them were criminals, some of them were wealthy people looking for money and so on, some were monks and nuns and saints and so on. But I realized there was one thing that tied all of them together. Everybody was looking for the same thing I was looking for. Everybody wanted happiness. Some mafiosi thought they would find happiness in revenge, in power, in money, but they'll find out sooner or later it doesn't work that way. Everybody in the world is looking for happiness. They're looking to avoid pain and find happiness. That, I realized in this dream, that binds me to everybody. And from then on, I have felt so much love for everybody that I see in the streets. But sometimes I cannot help crying because I know they're all looking for that same thing, bliss. They may not know it yet, but they will know it in time. Bliss is only an octave above happiness. Happiness is only an octave above pleasure. And pleasure is only an octave above pain. But pain too is pleasure. Nothing in this world, everything God is, as Shankaracharya said, the Adi Shankara, Satchitananda. Master translated that to mean ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss. And God is ever newly blissful. And the wonderful thing is that every human being will express that bliss in a separate and different way. You will never be like Krishna or Shankaracharya or Yogananda or any other saint. You will be a unique saint in your way. Once you've gotten rid of all the superficial delusions that fuzz in your mind right now, that is not who you are. You are a saint in the making. And as long as you struggle to find happiness, you are still struggling to find God. The time will come when you will be just as spiritual as the greatest master who ever lived, because God is you and you are He. This is the great teaching of Sanatana Dharma, that we are that, thou art that. Now then, if this is the case, why bother to cheat a little bit to get a few pennies? Why do politicians tell lies in order to become powerful? Why do they take bribes in order to get more money? You know, I saw a movie, it's worth seeing if you haven't seen it. It's called Inside Job, of these wealthy American bankers and stockbrokers and so on, who use their money through derivatives. They didn't even spend their own money to get yachts and helicopters and everything. They made millions of people poor in order to reach their own wealth. I think people like that will become tigers in their next life. Or if they're not enough to become tigers, maybe they'll become cockroaches. I don't know. Scavengers. No, remember, you have to live for many lifetimes until you get freedom. Why do that which will take you downwards? When you see the poverty and the suffering in the slums of big cities in this world, I saw outside Howrah Station near Calcutta, I saw a group of gypsies holding out their hands, begging. And there was one young girl there, and she looked like a queen who was thinking, what am I doing in this body? It was just written all over her face. But when you live that way, you will become that kind of person. When you live basely, you will become base. Why do it? Why take that chance? Why not live rightly now? Your one life is only a brief time. The little money you have in the bank. You know, there was one person who went to a psychic to ask who he would be in his next life so that he could will all his money to that person. Well, that's one way of doing it, but I think it's much safer to have that money in the bank of good karma. That way you can be sure whatever you've left, you will pick up again. How did I come to the point of wanting to know God in this life when I was so young, only 21? Why? Because I had done it before. Whatever you have done before, you will continue to do. Why not get that kind of karma that will give you a sense of completeness in yourself? You are God. You are Brahman. And everything that you wanted. There was I know when the English came to India, they heard these devotees saying, horrible, horrible in Bengal. And they would say, horrible, horrible. Well, they can laugh, but they can't take away your peace. I've had people laugh at me for seeking God. I don't care if I have nothing. For a while there, I had to live on $10 a month. And I trained my palate to like powdered milk. And I decided a dessert wasn't so necessary, just one bite. So I'd make one dessert last a whole week. And many little tricks I found, I could live on nothing. You can do it too. Don't play with your own karma. Because there's one infallible law in the universe. And that is karma. I went to the Agastya reading. I went to Bhrigu Sanghita. Those were in Treta Yuga, descending Treta Yuga, 5,000 years ago, when they demolished the delusion of time. And they can see the future. And they wrote these books with pages on your life. And if you find a page there, you will see that this is true. But I found in that thing that everything was known. How was it known? Because it's my karma. Is my karma to be born in America? But I was certainly not an American. My guru used to say that many Indian souls are being born in America now. Many American souls are being born in India now.
to bring about a combination of these two, because the future will have a balance between material and spiritual efficiency. And so this is, I have seen men in Delhi who look like Wall Street brokers. And I've seen sadhus in India who look like Indian sadhus. The only difference is we have pale skin now. No other difference. I am at home in India as I never have been in America. Why? Your karma will decide. And karma is the supreme law. It rules what color tie you will put on this morning. How can these things be decided? Do you have any free will? Yes, you have this much free will to turn toward God or to turn away from Him. That much freedom you have. You have no other freedom. Once you turn one way or the other, karma will take over from there. So turn to God. This is my plea to you. God bless you. I would like to read to you, because I have written a book which we're going to be presenting now, and it's called The Time Tunnel. It doesn't have this foreword in it, and so I will read you the foreword. Just a moment. I get out my glasses here. What is a writer of philosophical works doing producing a work for children? Well, I have an honorable precedent in Lewis Carroll, Charles Dodgson, who wrote Alice in Wonderland. In my case, in an idle moment, 2 years ago, I picked up a copy of The Wizard of Oz and glanced at the first pages. I came to the section on the yellow brick road, which is almost at the beginning, when the thought came to me forcibly, why not write a book for children? Really, I must say, it wasn't my idea. It was just something that was, as it were, given to me. I sat down at my computer and I asked, all right, what is this story to be about? Suddenly the theme appeared in my mind. The story unfolded as I wrote it, concept by concept and episode by episode. The whole process was quite thrilling. From then on, I just sat back and let the ideas flow. In 2 weeks, the story wrote itself as you see it here, though like Donnie and Bobby in the story, I must truthfully admit that the dancing bears in Atlantis and the UFO in the next to the last chapter came to me later. What this book has enabled me to do is write concepts in which I believe, but for which I have no evidence. It is, in fact, quite a sophisticated book. Parents, I suspect, will be stealing it from their children to read themselves. I myself am nearly 86 now, and I enjoy it much more than I would have done when I was Donnie of the story. I hope you do too, and maybe you'll have a chance to go someday to the scene of the story. If you do, please write and tell me whether you found that ruined laboratory or laboratory. So anyway,